Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode number 27 of The Police and the People, and our first ever video recorded version of it using Zoom.
Yeah, so, number 27, huh?
Yeah. So now we're going to try to, you know, take the turn here and move into video elements, because we do now have a YouTube channel for GSPTC. So here we go. All right. So with today's episode, we're going to be talking about the Breonna Taylor incident. We're going to give you a little bit of a rundown on what actually happened, talk a little bit about tactics and policies these days, and also we're going to talk about no-knock warrants. What are they? Why do they exist? Et cetera. What the police have to prove to get those. And then last, we're going to end with a question, which is, what was our favorite position or rank during our career?
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
So, yeah, we were just talking about that a little bit before we started recording, but
sure,
we'll get to that in just a minute. So before we keep going, be sure to support us on Patreon, everyone. We'd really appreciate it. We need to get a little income to help pay for this podcast. And as we grow, we certainly want to be able to afford engineering costs and things of that nature, because I stink at it. So I would like to hire a professional to do it. So just like $5 a month is all we're asking. So if you could just pledge that much, we'd greatly appreciate it. That's at patreon.com/thepoliceandthepeople. And also, as many of you know who listen, and for those who don't, Josh and I are owners of Granite State Police Career Counseling, which is a law enforcement training company based out of New Hampshire. And COVID kicked us in the you-know-what. It really did, but it did force us to create an online platform. So if you go to our website, gs-pcc.com, again, gs-pcc.com, you can see what we offer for training. For in-class sessions and also for online sessions. Now, our online library is still relatively small. We only have 6 classes because we just created it. And but we have some good stuff there. Even one of the classes is free. And but we do have some good stuff coming up, right, Josh?
Yeah, we have some excellent classes
coming up. October and November and December, right?
Yep, we have, October is just about full, but we do have one class that has some room in it, and that is instructor development. That class is in Hampton, New Hampshire. It's a 2-day class. It's going to be taught by Phil White, who has become a little bit of a GSPCC celebrity here.
Yeah,
he's been on the podcast. He's been in some of the promotional videos, and now police officers around New England are starting to kind of learn about Phil White from California, who does some training for us. So that class is going towards the end of October. And then in November, we have a class that is digital forensics and social media investigations. Mm-hmm. That class is going to be up in Topsom, Maine. That's a great class. And the officers that take that class will actually be working with some devices and learning how to secure evidence off of those devices. And then when we get into December, we have leadership development in Newington, New Hampshire. And that's a 3-day class. And that's one of our most popular classes. It's a great class. And then last but not least, we have patrol skill build that is scheduled in November as well, in Hooksett, New Hampshire. And there is still some room in that class. Unfortunately, all of our other classes are full. We have 3 or 4 others that are going in 2020 that are full. So as you said, COVID was, you know, certainly an issue for us, but now I think what we're seeing is officers are signing up in bulk for training because everybody had to hit the pause button there in March and April, May of last year.
Yep. All right.
So go right to the website and you can sign up for any of those classes.
You can see the dates and times and register right there. If you want to pay by check, you can still register via the website, or if you want to pay by credit card, either way, it gives you a choice. All right. So enough of the business there. So let's talk about Breonna Taylor.
Yeah.
All right. So what actually happened? You have that, Josh?
Well, you know, we know that the police department in Louisville was serving a drug warrant, right? And this was part of a long-term investigation. And as a result of that investigation, they had applied for a no-knock warrant. And when they went to serve the warrant, unfortunately, they were met with resistance, right? Yep, and correct. An officer was fired upon and was actually struck by a mail party that was inside of the residence where they were serving the warrant. And that right. residence was where Breonna Taylor lived as well.
Yes.
So there ended up being an exchange of gunfire between the police and the mail party that was inside. And as a result, Breonna Taylor was killed by police gunfire. And again, a police right. officer was shot in that exchange as well. Yes. So this obviously caused a huge, huge issue in our communities and in our society, especially because of the current climate that police and communities are experiencing right now. And even more so, the communities of color being concerned with the interactions between police and people of color. So that, to me, that's really the crux of it. I mean, we can talk more about the details of this, but that seems to be the crux of the concerns with the incident, and the death of Breonna Taylor.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, before we go into that, let's talk about some things that were claimed to be true, but sure. when the reports came out, it turns out that they were not true. So let's make sure we kind of clear the air on that. And then I'd really like to have a discussion about policy moving forward.
Yeah. Yep.
Not that anything was done incorrectly. However, when these things do happen, you have to take a step back and go, should yeah. we have gone in the first place? You yeah. know, and that's not a knock on the police officers. Unfortunately, sometimes our biggest lessons learned are at the end of tragic events.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Absolutely.
So there was a claim that the officers failed to properly announce themselves.
Sure.
So this goes back to knock versus no knock warrants. Mm-hmm. From what I understand in the research that I did, they did not have a no knock warrant. In other words, they had to announce before they went in, before they breached a door. All right.
Yeah, and that's kind of gone back and forth. I mean, we hear reports that it was a no-knock warrant, then we hear reports that it was a knock and announce warrant, and you know that's obviously the subject of a lot of the criticism of yeah. the actions of the police. Absolutely, so absolutely.
Right here, the warrant for Taylor's home was secured as a no-knock warrant, mm-hmm. Which allows police to enter a home without announcing themselves. Mattingly said in his recorded statement to investigators, however, that he and his team were told to knock on the door and announce themselves.
Right, right.
So what that tells me is it was probably a salty police officer, probably a lieutenant or something, who looked at this and said, let's not do a no-knock. Let's announce. All right.
Right.
And there's pros and cons to both of that, but and we'll get into that when we talk about policy. So according to what the officer said and according to a witness in a different apartment, they heard the police announce themselves, right. bang the door and announce police. Okay.
Right.
All right. So there's that one. And then there was a claim that Taylor was asleep in her bed when she was struck by a bullet. And that is not true.
Right.
It has been found to be false. She was actually standing right next to her boyfriend, who's the one that shot the police officer. So when they returned fire, she was right in the line of fire.
Right.
So she was not in her bed. And again, we're going to talk more about policy stuff in a minute. So that was false. That officers arrested their actual target hours before Taylor was shot. It turns out that was uncertain, that the target was arrested, but not at that apartment, but the target had listed where she lives as her address.
As a residence, right. Had
his residence, which is why the police were there. All right. So, and there's no indication that Taylor was involved with drug sales, but her former boyfriend who lived there and listed that place as an address was. That was right. what they were investigating.
And we've heard from the more, I guess, conservative side that has maybe suggested that Breonna Taylor had some involvement in the drug trade. And from what I have researched, that has been debunked. So, you know, you have to make it clear, you know, and this is a person that can't defend themselves at this point in the media or in the press. It does not appear that Breonna Taylor, from everything we've gathered, had any activity with the drug trade.
Correct.
I don't There's know if no you've, if you've read anything else.
No,
right.
No. And that the police entered the wrong apartment. That's another one that's kind of floating out there, but that's not true. They entered correct address. Because that does happen. That police
absolutely
go in the wrong place, especially when it comes to apartments.
Yep.
Because sometimes they're confusing because they all kind of look the same. So, so I just wanted to put some of those to rest before we continued on. So now moving on to policy. You know, I think this incident does allow us to ask the question, should they have even gone in at all, right? And the reason I say that is because right before I retired, the regional SWAT team that my agency was part of had created a policy that they were no longer going to do entries for drug warrants. They weren't going to be hitting the doors and throwing in flashbangs and going in to make it safe. They were going to surround and call out. And they made that clear to all detective divisions, because it's usually the detectives that are running these drug investigations. And when they set up to do the search, if they feel it's unsafe, they'll have a SWAT team come in first and make the house safe. And they do that by kicking in the door and throwing flashbangs and going in. I know I used to do that. However, the command staff for the regional team decided that they weren't going to do that anymore. And the reason was safety, for the officers and safety for people inside. So now this begs the question, and I am not Monday morning quarterbacking this, but maybe a better policy is to surround and call out. Of course, the downside is what?
Well, you have people they're either able to destroy evidence, or if people come out and now they're engaging the police, you know, out in the public, now maybe you've lost some of that control that you have inside of a building.
Right.
So, you know, it is a calculated decision that police officers have to make. And, you know, I would argue that there's no right decision and there's no wrong decision.
Right.
You have to look at them on a case by case basis.
You do.
You know,
you
have to look at them on a case by case basis. And as you know, and I was a member of a SWAT team, not as a tactical officer, as a hostage negotiator, many tactical teams have almost like a matrix that they use. Right.
Yeah.
And they start saying, you know, prior contacts with the people. If there have been violent prior contacts, there's a check in that box.
No, and so weapons, all of that. Yeah.
Right. And at the end of it, you add up all of your numbers. And if it reaches a certain number on a threat matrix, we'll call it, then that's how you make some of your decisions. It's not a perfect approach, but it's something, right? You have to you have to have some approach. You can't just kind of spit in the wind and say, oh, let's just see what happens. Because when you do that, that's when you have these tragedies, I think. So in that sense, I will Monday morning quarterback, not the folks in Louisville, but police officers in general. If you don't plan these incidents correctly, and if you don't prepare for these incidents correctly, that's where you're going to have tragedies. And so it's all in the preparation to me.
Yeah. So another thing though, I remember when I went through SWAT school and the main guy that was heading that up, I don't recall his name right now, but he was one of the original members of LA SWAT. And he pointed out that if you're going to be an operator for a SWAT team, you have to know surgical shooting. And that's what he called it. Precision surgical shooting. And you don't pull a trigger unless you are certain of your target. So just to Monday morning quarterback a little bit here, I was wondering if this was just shot was fired at them, and in response, just a hail of bullets went out instead of really verifying the target and taking the shot. I don't know the answer to that, but just something to consider.
Yeah. And I think that's probably something that is unfortunately very common with police officers. You know, you were a police officer, I was a police officer. When you have bullets coming at you, your first instinct is to fire back, right? And it's not the wrong instinct. You have to defend yourself. But similar to that comment that you heard, I can remember a firearms officer saying on the range, you own every bullet that comes out of this gun.
Yeah.
And so you have to understand, you know, you have to target acquisition and understanding the background, you know, what's going on behind your target and so on and so forth. And again, I'm not Monday morning quarterbacking because I wasn't there, but I can understand how the first instinct is to return fire. And I can also understand the need for police officers, including you and I when we worked, to own every bullet that comes out of our gun.
Yeah.
But understand these were not tactical officers, to my understanding. These were narcotics investigators, which goes back to when you're serving a warrant that maybe was a no-knock warrant or that got modified at some point, do you start to say to yourself, let's have a tactical team do this, because a tactical team has more experience with that surgical shooting that you were talking about.
Yeah.
For all of our listeners, we're just talking about ideas here. We're not, you know, we're not giving absolutes, but that to me is part of the success or failure of these operations, is to start talking about what could happen. And if it does, what can we do to be prepared for that? And one thing, again, I'm a big fan of tactical teams. You use them. They're there for a reason.
Yep.
And they have a skill set that other police officers don't always have.
And if your drug units are going to be doing these tactical entries, they need to be trained. They need to be trained on how to do this. Like the first person to the door, in my opinion, should have a shield.
Right.
The first person in this one, that bullet may not have hit the officer's leg.
Right.
So, because it was with a handgun. I know that shields are limited, that, you know, rifles will piss right through them. I know that. But, you know, it's better than nothing.
Well, you're cutting down your percentages now. You're saying, okay, we've got a shield. So unless it's a high powered rifle, we have, you know, a better chance of being successful here.
Right.
You just want to have, as police officers, you want to have every advantage so that you can end these incidents safely for the officers involved, safely for the suspects, safely for the people that are living in the apartments around or the homes around that area too. So that, you know, you want to take all of those factors into account.
Yeah. So for our civilians that are listening to our podcast, and we're very thankful that you are listening, because that's what this whole podcast is about. It's called The Police and the People, and that we just want to give you information and perspective from the police side. And we also bring in civilians sometimes to get their side of it as well. But for the civilians that are listening, we just want to also explain, what exactly is a no-knock warrant and what is a knock warrant and why do they exist? So typically, you want to announce yourself when you go to someone's home and you have a warrant to search it, right? Or even if you have an arrest warrant for someone there, you want to make your presence known. You want them to know it's the police. Now, in the whole drug world, no-knock warrants were developed because what they were finding was that people were destroying evidence. So you're knocking on the door, police, please open up, please open up. Meanwhile, you can hear the toilets flushing, right? So the big thing is that it destroys evidence. Also, no-knock warrants are good for dangerous people. So if you're going to hit someone's house at 2 a.m. when you know that they're probably asleep, you don't want to wake them up by knocking. You want to get in that house quickly and basically get in their OODA loop, right? Get inside that OODA loop so they can't respond. So you've just made them 100% useless. And we used to do that, you know, when you throw in a concussion grenade and at 2 a.m. and all of a sudden there's 10 guys, you know, in that house flooding it, there's not much you can do but just give up, Right.
Dominate the incident was a term that I heard.
Yeah.
That I always used to hear. We're going to go in and we're going to dominate the room.
Exactly. You do. And you go in as fast as, you know, you can comfortably shoot, but with a swiftness and saturate the house. So those were some of the reasons that no-knock warrants were developed. All right. Now, I think in New Hampshire, I think they prefer. So when I get a search warrant in New Hampshire, it's assumed that it's going to be a knock warrant. In order for me to have that label as no knock, I have to prove to the judge that's signing it that I need to not knock, right? That there are certain reasons behind it. So you have to prove it. And I'm assuming most states are like that as well. It's not like just a given assumption that it's a no knock. You actually have to take it to the next level and prove it. So at least that's been my experience with them in the past. Just a quick story. We did a hit on a guy one time. He was a dangerous dude and he was wanted. He was staying at a no-tell motel and I was part of the entry team, and the flashbang went in through a window off the back of the motel room that went into a bathroom, right? They just broke the window and threw the grenade in. As soon as it went off, we went in the front door, but the flashbang fell into a pair of his girlfriend's underwear, let's just say, and it caught on fire. So we're going into a room that's full of smoke, and there's the fire alarm's going off, and we got these two naked people because we caught them doing you know what. And, but we definitely saturated that.
Yeah. Yeah.
if he wanted to do anything, it was just to get the hell out of there. Cause the room was on fire that we caused.
Yep. And that's, I guess, what we're talking about. You know, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. So you need to prepare for all of those things to go wrong. And even after you prepare, there's always going to be something that you didn't prepare for. But to just simply say, well, we're going to go knock on a door or we're going to go kick a door in and everything will be fine. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, that old saying, failing to prepare is preparing to fail.
Yep.
And the problem is, once you prepare and half a dozen times nothing happens, it becomes very, very easy to start to let your guard down. Yep. And that's just human nature, right? Yep. That's human nature, and police officers are human. And so what ends up happening is once you prepare properly a bunch of times and nothing happens, and then you kind of take it half speed a few times and you get lucky and nothing happens, you just kind of feel like, well, nothing ever happens. It's, you know, it's foolish for us to spend all of this time preparing, and then sooner or later it gets you. You may get away with it once, twice, you may get away with it 100 times, and but the more times that you roll the dice, sooner or later it will get you, and somebody will get hurt, or God forbid, somebody will get killed. And that's the unfortunate thing, because police officers are humans.
They are humans. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. So let's move on to now the decision from the AG's office in Kentucky to not indict the officers for, I'm not sure what they were seeking. I know they were
seeking an indictment.
Indictment, but for what? For murder charge?
I don't have it right in front of me, but there were multiple charges that they were seeking indictment, and they only got one, and that was for almost, you know, in our words,
reckless.
In New Hampshire, recklessness is really maybe the best layman's term for it, is a recklessness of one of the officers.
Because sounds like he was just blindly shooting, and some of the rounds went into
another
apartments. Again, apartments.
Yeah.
Get SWAT teams because they know what they're doing. And they also, a lot of them carry specific rounds that they don't want penetrating walls, you know, like shotguns, you have tactical slugs that aren't as powerful, right?
Very sluggish, sluggish round.
Yeah.
It'll stop something, but it doesn't, it's not a high powered round that'll go right through
something. It's not like
something.
A slug for hunting, right? And there's also tap rounds for 223 rounds that are made to make them break up as soon as they hit things. So, one officer was indicted for that wanton recklessness. that he was charged with. He was also fired.
Right. And yeah. That was even before the indictment, I believe, that, correct. That, yeah, he, was that he was terminated.
Yeah, he was fired in June. Yeah, because of the recklessness. And I don't know if there's an internal fight with that, but he probably will not get his job back if I were a gambling person.
Yeah, very difficult to be effective as a police officer after an incident like this.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. And I know he was laying down, you know, fired because one of his... one of the three guys was shot, you know, right. So it's yep. instinctive to want to just fire back and suppress everything so you can get your mm-hmm. guy out of there. But you got to remember, this isn't the military. You're not in Afghanistan, you know, these are paper thin walls in these apartment mm-hmm. complexes, and those rounds can hit other people. And they have, you know,
yep.
So anyway, yep. the AG decided not to indict the other officers, to include the one that fired the shot that killed Brianna. And I actually have, I'll show you a quick, like 7-minute video right here from Tucker Carlson that talks about it.
Or didn't know all the information. They made conclusions first and then want to cherry pick the facts to meet those conclusions. I don't have that luxury as the Attorney General here in the Commonwealth. My responsibility is to the truth and to the information, and then that is ultimately what leads to the conclusion. We presented all of the information to the grand jury. Ultimately, we presented to them as well the fact that the officers, Mattingly and Cosgrove, were fired upon, and they were justified in returning their fire. We've obviously have a prosecution into a third officer that was there that night. I can't get into the specifics because that is an ongoing prosecution. But again, a lot of folks had already made up their mind and weren't interested in what the truth is, and now are still trying to cherry pick so that they can fashion a narrative that meets their agenda and advances their own interests.
Man, I hope someday we can have dinner, and I'm going to ask you what you think of the many other prosecutors who've bowed to political pressure, but I'm not going to ask you that on TV because... could be putting you in a bad spot. In the meantime,
I'm going to take you up on that dinner.
I hope so. Yes, Daniel Cameron, Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Thanks so much.
That was the AG that decided. He didn't decide. It was actually the grand jury. It just didn't indict.
Right.
So, just so everyone understands that, you know, a grand jury is made up of 24 or 25.
It really depends because, you know, sometimes you have members of a grand jury that have to recuse themselves for various reasons too.
Right, yeah.
So when you get a grand jury pool, you usually you have many people, and then at times you have to remove people for various reasons.
Right.
But it's a large group of people. You know, in New Hampshire, like you said, you might walk into a grand jury room and, you know, there's 25, 26, 27 people in that room.
Yeah, I used to have to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they return what they call a true bill in most states, where basically the grand jury looks at the circumstances and determines, okay, is there enough information or enough evidence here that we feel the case should be heard by a judge or a jury? And so then they bind that case over for, in New Hampshire, it would be Superior Court.
Exactly. So
if a grand jury doesn't indict, if they determine, there isn't enough evidence here to support that charge, then they do not return what's called in New Hampshire a true bill.
Right, right. And just so to kind of break it down for our non-police people that are listening. So when you go into a grand jury, right? So you have had a case, right? And let's say you have a charge on someone, and in most states, grand juries are brought together for felony cases. They don't necessarily do it for misdemeanors,
right?
Maybe in special occasions. So now you're looking at a felony charge here. Now, maybe you've worked a case and you've got probable cause that this person committed this crime. You go before a magistrate with your arrest warrant, and the judge says, yep, I've read it. You definitely have probable cause. They sign it authorizing the arrest of that person. But in a lot of states now, because it's a felony, you have to also indict them. So it's a nice mechanism. It's a nice double mechanism there to make sure that probable cause is even met. And I'm not sure how it is in other states, but in New Hampshire, if it happens at the local level, then even if they're charged with a felony that's going to be moving on to a different prosecutor, a higher level prosecutor, they can even fight the case at a probable cause hearing at the district level. So right. There's all these different ways that they can, you know, basically attack your investigation to make sure a probable cause exists. The judge is going to make sure. They could have a probable cause hearing before it moves on. And then there's the indictment process, and all of these mechanisms make sure that you have probable cause that it's more likely than not this person committed this crime. So typically, whenever you're in front of a grand jury, you've gone through this filter process already. So most of the time, you're going to get a true bill, right. Unless you're just really bad, right? Unless right. Your case is just absolutely horrible.
Right.
So, but it shouldn't have made it through the filter process in the beginning, if that's the case.
So if I could just comment on that, Tim. And then on the flip side of it, so again, you mentioned, you know, multiple steps. There are some cases, and this being one of them, it sounds like, where you say, we're not going to seek an arrest warrant. We're going to go right to the grand jury step and have the case kind of vetted and reviewed. And that happens quite often in New Hampshire. And as you said, there was a time when a probable cause hearing might be held after an arrest. And a lot of states, it's my understanding, and in New Hampshire, we got rid of that probable cause hearing it must have been about 2 years ago, the last year or two of my career, where cases that were, if a case was an arrest on a felony charge, it went through what they called the felonies first portal and was kind of rocket rided right to the superior court level. Yeah. And that's just a more efficient way of getting these cases in front of a superior court judge. But if you have a case that is very sensitive, that maybe needs to be reviewed by somebody other than the police, then you can go right to the grand jury step, which is what I think they did here. And it's kind of an easy way for a prosecutor's office to say, we're going to put this case in front of the grand jury and let a group of people review the facts and circumstances and decide if people did something wrong, if there was made an error in law, what was, you know, what were the circumstances here?
Right.
So I think that's probably why it went right to the grand jury level in this case.
And the grand jury did the right thing. So I'm sure everyone has noticed this, but when these situations happen where a white police officer shoots a black suspect, it seems like the prosecutors are just so quick to charge. They want to just go right to, you know, first degree murder, right? These hard charges, heavy, heavy charges, instead of just waiting until see what the investigation reveals. Because what we're seeing now is this, you know, that these prosecutors get heavy handed and then the officers don't get charged or they go to trial and it gets lost.
Sure.
And the officers win because they didn't meet the elements of the crime. Right. Which is what happened here in Kentucky. I'm sorry, Josh, I'll let you speak in just a minute. I just want to say that was what happened. So they presented possible charges. I think there were a litany of them that they could have possibly gone with. And these were the elements of those. And if you know anything about prosecuting, you have to meet these elements of the crime, right? And they just didn't. They just didn't. You can't put a square peg in a round hole, right?
Right.
Yeah, just make it up, make it happen. So that's why these officers weren't indicted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've said it on our podcast before. It's very, very dangerous to start casting judgment or making judgment until you have all of the facts, right?
Go figure.
And it almost goes hand in hand with the Breonna Taylor incident that if you don't take your time, if you don't prepare properly, if you don't connect all of your dots and make sure that you've done your homework and dot your I's and cross your T's, that's where you have problems.
Right.
And I heard an activist make a comment and say the system worked based on the way the system is set up.
Yeah.
So you can argue that there's a breakdown in the system.
Okay.
That you know, that maybe we shouldn't have no-knock warrants, or as you mentioned in your department, maybe we shouldn't be serving high-risk drug warrants. Or, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of dialogue there that is really worthwhile to have. Mm-hmm. But as that particular activist said, the police were doing police things. They were working within their the parameters of their job. And he said, yep, you can't fault law enforcement for returning fire when they are fired upon. Right. Now, as you pointed out, and I think you pointed out correctly, though, you need to know where the bullets are going. You can't just fire blindly and say, well, somebody's shooting at me, so I'm shooting back. Right. No, you're not shooting back. You're just shooting blindly. Yep. And unfortunately, that's when people get hurt. Yep. The wrong, you know, you shoot unarmed people. So when you start to talk about the lack of indictment, as you pointed out, the prosecutor can only work within the system that he or she is presented. The police can only work within the system that they are presented. The members of the grand jury, the judge, the defense attorneys, they can only work within the system that they are presented.
Right.
So I think there can be some dialogue about the system, but to blame this prosecutor per se, and I've heard, you know, a lot of comments about that, I think that's very unfair. And it's very, you know, it's ignorant in the sense that you have people that maybe just don't understand the process.
Right. Exactly. And they're blaming him, but I mean, it went to a grand jury.
Right.
And they didn't, right. They said no. So,
right.
I mean, that's that. He did his job. He presented some options to them and
right.
They said no.
The one that they chose, it, people just don't feel that is of enough consequence. Right.
I guess they
feel that charge is just not, you know, they feel that there should have been stronger charges, you know, whether it be manslaughter or murder rather
right.
than a reckless charge.
For the officers that actually struck
were indicted.
The one that the bullet that actually killed her, that officer should be held accountable in some way. Right. But again, it's he didn't get up that morning and say, I'm going to go kill someone today.
You know? Sure.
It's all in response to, you know, a shot being fired at them. So,
yep.
All right. You ready to move on to the question?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
You want to go first or you want me
to
go first?
So the question is, what was your favorite position or rank during your career? So I spent 20 years in law enforcement, had all kinds of positions. And I'll start with saying that my least favorite was the one that I was in the longest, was being a lieutenant. Now, I want to set this up. I'm not saying I hated my job. I'm just saying of all the positions I've been in, like sergeant, you know, patrol sergeant, detective, patrol officer, that was the detective part, the administrative part. I'm sorry. Yeah, the lieutenant administrative part was not my favorite. But of the others, I just truly enjoyed them so, so much, so thoroughly. And if I had to say of the ones that I did enjoy, probably being a sergeant was one of my favorites, because I grew as a leader. You know, there's a lot I had to learn, mm-hmm. and it made me a much better officer. But I enjoyed helping others grow, mm-hmm. you know, helping others become better at their jobs. I truly, truly enjoyed that.
Yep.
How about you, man?
I enjoyed being a detective the most. I was a detective for about 6 years, and very similar to you, I was a patrol officer, I was a detective, I was a patrol sergeant, I was ultimately the deputy chief of my department. Mm-hmm. And being a detective, there was a sense of accomplishment as a detective, because you were able to see a case through. I always kind of considered myself a thinking man's cop, so to speak. I enjoyed the strategy of, okay, we're going to do surveillance here, or we're going to go question this person and see if we can gather some evidence here. Yeah. I enjoyed interviews and interrogations of suspects. So I enjoyed that kind of game of chess. Yep. And even when it frustrated me, because you don't catch everybody and, you know, sometimes they slip through your fingers, but I still enjoyed that process. And similar to you, I didn't not like being the deputy chief of police, but nobody becomes a cop to sit behind a desk, right? That's right. Nobody signs up saying, hey, I think, you know, I'll enjoy sitting behind a desk and, you know, as you've commented, reviewing policy and doing evaluations and looking at internal investigations. Mm-hmm. Nobody becomes a police officer to do those things. It's just, it's the way your career takes you. So as a detective, you do sit behind a desk a lot. You do type a lot, but you're also, I was a guy that was kind of always out on the prowl, so to speak. You know, I was out at all hours of the night trying to chase down leads, and I enjoyed it. I don't know how much my family enjoyed it when I was doing that. I think they liked me having a more regular schedule as an administrator, but I enjoyed the detective work and the fact that it was so diverse too. You know, you always had different stuff you were investigating, or at least I did.
Yeah, we were like that. We were kind of a jack of all trades.
Yeah, general investigations.
Yeah, because we didn't have, well, the only specialized unit we had was juvenile.
Sure.
And they took care of, they were, did all that. So, but I did burglaries, robberies, drugs, financial crimes, you name it. I was doing it. So.
And that, I was the same way. And so I enjoyed having different stuff. And you got to work with different police officers from different organizations. Yep. You worked with other local officers, county, federal, state officers. You worked with officers from administrative units. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed all that diversity too.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good time. I will say with detectives, it was probably the one position that I felt more stressed just because, you know, I would take stuff home with me, not literally, but in my mind. You know, did I do this right? Should I have question them a different way, you know, things like that. So
I always used to say, when you're in patrol and you go off shift, somebody picks up your unit of work. Somebody else goes out on patrol. When you're a detective and you go home, your cases just sit there. Yeah. Nobody picks it up for the most part. You might have other detectives that will chase down a lead or two for you, but in the end, it is still your case, your responsibility. So yes, you find that when you took a vacation after about 2 or 3 days, you start thinking about, what do I have to do when I get back? What's happening with my cases right now? Because you become so invested in them.
Yeah. And you go on a, go on a 1 week vacation, you come back, and now you got 20 new cases.
Right. Yes.
What?
Yep. Yes. Absolutely. Yep.
All right, man. I think we've done enough damage for today.
Yes.
So, a couple of things before we close. Please subscribe to our podcast, and we're now going to be on YouTube. So we'd ask that you subscribe to that as well. Hit the notification bell. That way you'll know when we've put up new ones. This is going to be new, so I'm not sure when I'm going to get this out. So I have to learn all this. But you, if you just want to listen to the audio version, you can tune in on iTunes, which is now actually Apple Podcasts. They changed their name. Yep. iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, and Alexa. You can follow us on pretty much every social media. We're out there. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. Anything with GSPCC in it, that's typically us. And we also have a monthly newsletter that we sign people up when they go to our classes. But if you would like to be on it, all you have to do is go to our website. As soon as you go onto the main page, there's going to be a pop-up in the right bottom right. And all you have to do is give your email address, and then you're on our newsletter. We put that out once a month. We typically focus on something that's topical in law enforcement. And then we also talk a little bit about nutrition and health. We highlight what we call Blue Cape Award, you know, officers that have gone above and beyond and enacted some, you know, heroic features about them. And then that's about it, right? We have a couple of people we like, a couple of businesses that are on there. But anyway, that's our monthly newsletter. So anything else, Josh?
No, it's just great to talk with you.
Yeah, it's been a while, you know.
Yeah.
It's COVID, between COVID, the business work, and our other jobs mm-hmm. and our families, sure. it's just really tough to get together to do yeah. this. But maybe now yeah. with this Zoom situation we have now, I can't even think of the right word, we can do more and have a video element to it as well.
Sure. So,
anyway, absolutely. All right, everyone. That's it for us. And we'll talk to you later. Be safe.
Take care.
There.